We came across the word Twitter, and it was just perfect. The definition was a short burst of inconsequential information and chirps from birds, and that's exactly what the product was. So said Jack Dorsey, co-founder of Twitter, explaining the origin of the name. If Twitter is inconsequential, why did it perhaps play a role in furthering the Arab Spring, capturing the Boston Marathon suspects, and stimulating discussion in college classrooms around the world? I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Our guest today assigns Twitter essays in his college classes and last year launched what he calls an epic, zombified experiment in Twitter literacy, gamification, collaboration, and emergent learning called Twitter versus Zombies, billed as part flash mob, part Hunger Games, and part digital feeding frenzy. What were the results of the Twitter versus Zombies experiment, and what is the point of Twitter? Joining us is Jesse Stommel, professor in the Division of Continuing Studies and a specialist in digital humanities.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Hi. Nice to be with you.
Trying to think if we could do this in a way that all of your answers and all of our questions would be 140 characters or fewer. But it's too much of a challenge. The thing about Twitter is, did it actually replace anything? What is the niche for Twitter that made it such a runaway success? It's only been around for 7 years.
Well, the thing I'll say first is that I think that I had a fantastic introduction from Emily, but the thing that was missing from that was my Twitter handle. And just so if anyone wants to follow along while we're talking, my Twitter handle is @Jessifer, which is the @ and then @JessiFer. To get to your question, the Twitter founders actually say that what was unique about Twitter and one of the things that they were really excited by was that it wasn't replacing anything. And so essentially what it did is it gave them this kind of open platform and it really figured out what it was as it went along. When I first signed on to Twitter, it was in early 2007. So the software launched in 2006 and it didn't really become popular until around April of 2007. I think that's right around when I signed on. And when I signed on, the sort of stereotype of Twitter was that it was telling people what you were having for breakfast. And just giving a sort of day-to-day monitor of what you were up to. Like at any given moment, you could just say, I'm out having lunch with so-and-so.
But Facebook would do that too.
Yeah, and a lot of platforms gave you. Well, and actually Facebook's ability or Facebook's sort of emphasis on that changed in the wake of Twitter. The sort of notion of just giving day-to-day updates of what you were doing. That's what Twitter created. But the thing is that Twitter moved very quickly on and away from that. Twitter is such a simple platform, 140 characters. And what they discovered really quickly is it became – they talk about it being not a social media but being an information media, that it was not about sharing – so it became quickly not about sharing social tidbits of your day-to-day life but about sharing information, about the sort of proliferation of information, how information can move across a group of people. The same way that we would talk about the headlines from that day's paper over the water cooler, Twitter became sort of a mass way to talk about what was going on. And the interesting thing for me is that Twitter became a place for us to talk about culture in maybe a way – it was almost like a back channel to culture. So it gave us a venue to talk about culture in new ways and sometimes in – and this is why I like Twitter – and sometimes in ways that really pushed the boundaries of the way that popular culture was talking about things.
And why 140 characters? Why that length?
I actually don't know the history of why that length, but I want to speculate on it just from the perspective of someone who studies literature and just to think about – And also someone who's a teacher, and to think about what happens when you give people constraints. When you give people constraints, there's a way in which you could immediately say, well, wow, if you give such a specific constraint, it's going to limit creativity. But I actually think just the opposite. Often when you give people constraints, it creates all kinds of possibilities
those
constraints.
A sonnet has constraints.
Yeah,
or haiku.
And it requires you to be succinct. And there's not a lot of room for flab.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that thing is the best users of Twitter are really thinking about every character. And when you think about a tweet that can be the biggest tweet of this year was shared 400,000 times. And when you think about something that can spread that wide, be shared 400,000 times, and that means it's not just 400,000 people that saw it. everyone in all of those 400,000 people's Twitter feeds had the ability to see this tweet. So I can only speculate at how many.
How does that work, though? You obviously have to subscribe to Twitter or to be a follower of this person who's making this 400,000 times followed tweet. So this must have been somebody who had a lot of followers.
Yeah, so it was a famous movie star. Lea Michele from Glee was the biggest tweet of 2013.
Now, what does that tell us about Twitter, though?
Well, and the thing is, though, that from my perspective, I actually don't follow her. I know about this only as a curiosity. I don't follow her, so I didn't even see that tweet, nor did I really care about that tweet because that's not really how I use Twitter. So there's a way in which I can curate my feed so that I'm seeing a bunch of celebrities, but I can also curate my feed so that I'm seeing other academics, or in my case, I like to curate my feed so I'm seeing a range of people who are interested in education, commingled with a few outliers who are interested in other things.
It's based on who you choose to follow.
Who you choose to follow. So you really, I mean, the thing that I tell any new Twitter user is you really have to think critically and think really consciously about assembling your feed, assembling the people that you follow. Don't just willy-nilly follow people. Really curate the list so that what you're seeing is a river of people that you've carefully chosen.
Well, let me play devil's advocate for
good.
It. All right. So I'm already drowning in emails and Facebook postings. If I go into Facebook, I do see photographs of what people had for breakfast, literally, and all kinds of scores on games that they got and you know, all sorts of trivial details are on Facebook already. Text messages from students about their homework. If I add on Twitter, where is it that you just go out and live? In other words, if we're so busy tweeting and posting on Facebook and emailing and text messaging, at what point do we just go out and get in a sled and go down the hill and quit worrying about if anyone saw a picture of us doing it?
I have two answers. One is to bring up a book that I think is something that I like to recommend when people ask that question. It's a recent book by Howard Rheingold called Net Smart. And what he talks about in that is he talks about two things. He talks about filter failure and he talks about crap detection. And essentially what he's talking about is we can't stop the flow. We can't stop the flow of information. Instead, what we can do is we can build our digital literacy by doing this sort of thinking more critically about what information is coming at you. Now, to answer your question from a personal perspective, I don't think we should have all of those different media coming at us at any given moment. And I've actually chosen in my own life to limit the number of spaces that I really occupy. So I am on all the social media from the perspective of a researcher and from the perspective of being interested in those spaces. I don't actually occupy them. I don't pay attention to what's happening in them. Also, I think that, even just when you think about your cell phone, your email, postal mail. I mean, when we think about all the stuff we had to filter even before social media, it gets huge. And the thing is, I tell people things like, I'm not available by the phone, for example, because I've chosen really carefully which spaces I'm going to occupy. Send me a text message or find me on Twitter. And even email, I've started to sort of move away from email and try and encourage people to contact me otherwise, because I literally can't handle the number of media that we're trying to juggle at any given moment.
That's one way to find out how serious they are, too. I mean, if they actually have to figure out which way to communicate with you rather than just kind of casually sending off an email. So what's the grammar of Twitter?
Well, interestingly, I want to respond to the previous thing that you said, and then maybe this will be a segue into the grammar. My dad uses Twitter, and he's tweeted about 21 times, and you go look at his feed – and half of those tweets are, Jesse, call me. Because he knows he can get a hold of me that way. And that
but
leads
does,
me.
But 20,000 other people see that?
No, just the people who follow my dad see that, or if I retweeted it, or anyone doing a search. Like if they're searching for my dad, they'll find his tweets. Like any listener to this can it's at Joe Stommel if you want to go read my father's really wonderful, wonderful tweets. But the thing, when I get to the grammar, I think that Twitter, and I think this is true of any media, but Twitter is a medium where you're often trying to have a really clear rhetorical impact. There's a reason for your tweet. Tweets aren't just thrown out willy-nilly. Oftentimes, when you're tweeting something, you have an action. You sort of have a
call to action.
A call to action. oftentimes you're tweeting an article that you just read and you want other people to read it. And so to me, what the grammar of Twitter is, it's a really careful grammar of how can I best get someone to follow my call to action.
And how do you screen out advertising then?
How do you screen out advertising?
Yeah,
well, I think that actually it's pretty easy to screen out advertising
because you know
the people that you're following. And so you recognize it's much different from a newspaper where you don't know the authors and you can often be duped into thinking that you're reading an article and then you realize two-thirds of the way through that you're actually reading an advertisement where they actually try and trick you and make you think that you're seeing something from someone you trust.
So not an issue.
Well, I mean, it is an issue. It's an issue, I mean, but it comes to the filter failure thing. It means you have to be really careful to sort of know who you're following and know what kinds of things they share.
And you can unfollow them?
You can unfollow them. Yeah, if someone's sharing too much of what you would consider advertising, you can certainly unfollow them.
So let's talk about the social part of this. I remember back when MySpace was sort of the big thing, The Onion had a parody headline that said, MySpace crashes, no one has any friends. You know, this idea that if you lose the social network, people feel as if their friends are gone. And even with Facebook, where you call it friends, but often it's people you barely know. With the whole Twitter, Facebook phenomenon, is it a kind of fake fellowship that for some people then has the illusion of friendship when it's not?
I would say no. And that's at least my experience. But I think you have to work hard to make it real. It isn't by its nature. But that's true about any kinds of interactions that we have. Even talking to someone at the bus stop isn't real unless you really make an effort to make it real. I would actually say that and this surprised me a little bit because I used Twitter a lot in my research and in my teaching from 2007 to 2011. But I didn't really start occupying the space fully until 2011, so relatively recently, because it took me a long time to really figure out what it was and how I wanted to exist in that space. But I've actually found that some of my deepest friendships have been now developed over Twitter. They usually need, though, a face-to-face – not always, but they need some sort of face-to-face component to really solidify their relationship. But if you think about famous authors who wrote letters to each other and the bulk of their relationship was in their correspondence and – they might have seen each other one time and then they developed this really, really deep, deep friendship over correspondence. I think that Twitter can certainly allow for that. It doesn't by its nature, but neither does a pen and paper by its nature create those kind of relationships.
Now, if you wanted to send, though, a one-on-one tweet, how would you exclude all those other followers from it?
So there's two ways to have a sort of direct communication in Twitter. One is via what's called a direct message, which is really a private message that you send to someone that no one else sees. So there's sort of a behind the scenes, very similar to a text message layer of Twitter. It's not really used for the most part, at least by me. I don't use it extensively because part of the excitement and part of the interest of Twitter for me is its publicness. On the other hand, even when I send a tweet directly to someone by at mentioning them, it's called, by essentially referring to them at the beginning of a tweet, sends it directly to them. And other people could see it, but they don't necessarily see it. So I like to liken it to having a conversation at a coffee shop where other people could overhear, but they're not likely to unless they're trying to hear. Mm-hmm. And so Twitter has various different – when you get to the grammar, various different ways that you send a message in order to – convey whispering or in order to convey talking at the top of your voice.
So how do you whisper?
So you whisper by essentially at mentioning someone at the beginning of the tweet. So if at the beginning of my tweet I said at Emily Auerbach, how's it going today? Essentially what's going to happen is you and anyone that follows both of us is going to see that tweet in their feed.
Oh, it has to be both of you.
But if he's not following both of us, then he's not going to see it in his feed. However, he could do a search for you, and then he'd see it. So it's literally if he wants to hear, he can hear.
And how do the hashtags follow into this?
So the hashtags are essentially a way to tag ideas in a conversation, to basically say this is what this conversation is about. And hashtags become a way to search a particular topic. So if you're interested in reading, one of the biggest – it actually crashed the servers of Twitter in 2009 was Michael Jackson's death. Mm-hmm. And I think something in the order of – I don't know if I can pull the number, but something like 100,000 tweets, 400,000 tweets in an hour or something like that, which is now – you know, Twitter's much huger now than it was then. So that's an increase. So the last big moment was 2013 Japanese New Year, where it was 30,000 tweets per second. At the when the clock struck midnight in that in the Japanese time zone. So to get back to your question, which was now I'm
hashtags
lost.
Hashtag. What exactly?
So you would hashtag Michael Jackson or you would hashtag Japanese New Year, and then people would be able to click on that hashtag and see all of the tweets related to that particular conversation.
Whose tweets?
So if I tweeted something with hashtag Michael Jackson.
Right.
Someone could click on hashtag Michael Jackson when they were seeing my tweet in their feed.
Right.
And then all of the tweets that have been hashtag Michael Jackson would appear.
For how long? I mean,
oh, so they see 400,000 tweets?
Sure. Well, as many as the servers could actually show you at any given moment. And Twitter likes to show you what's called top tweets instead of all tweets. So initially, when you clicked on that, you would see the top tweets with that hashtag. But then there'd be a button you could click that would say all tweets. And then you would see all of the tweets. You'd have to scroll a long way to get through this 30,000 per second.
Is there a search function once you get it to all those tweets?
There is a search. It actually is a really robust search function. It's grown over time. So the search has become more and more robust over time. And they're still trying to figure out what the sort of nature of the searching is.
Sure.
There's a way in which Twitter is also used as a search engine. When people are doing research, you can go search on Google. You can also go search on Twitter to find articles about a particular topic. And in some cases it might be more effective because you'd find really timely articles by searching Twitter.
That's right.
I noticed that increasingly now on television shows, there is a thing on the bottom that'll, you know, where you're supposed to be tweeting your reaction to, oh, let's say a singing contestant or something else, so that I'm assuming it's used in part to promote a sense of community about a show or and maybe we should talk about the business. Because people are obviously going to be making money in some way off the presence of Twitter. How has it become kind of a business bonanza?
Well, so the hashtag, you raise a great point. The hashtag can be used to form a community around a particular topic, but it also becomes a sort of advertising because then anytime we, you know, sure, we get a community around American Idol formed with that hashtag. But is that really the reason they're saying hashtag American Idol? No, they're probably doing it because they want – essentially they want you to tag and say you're talking about us because that way hashtag American Idol becomes a trending topic, shows up on the front page of Twitter, and all of a sudden all of this buzz about American Idol is right there at everyone in the world, at least everyone who's on the Twitter, right at their fingertips. I think it becomes a business model when we essentially try and sell the interactions that – people are having around a particular thing.
Right.
I mean, it's that saying that if you don't know what the product is, then the product is probably you. And I think that Twitter uses that pretty effectively.
And who makes money the most? I mean, if the Twitter company, their money comes from what?
Well, so Twitter was one of these companies that didn't have a business model when they first launched. And they, similar to Facebook, they didn't have a business model for a long time. The idea was let's become one of the biggest sites on the web and then we'll figure out how to monetize ourselves later. It worked. I don't think that business model works in every case, the sort of, you know, do-it-yourself business model or sort of find-it-as-you-go business model, advertising. And then the other thing is selling people's data. So how do people interact on Twitter? What are they searching for? What are people of particular demographics looking for? And there's, you know, think about all the marketing and ad agencies that want that data about how are you interacting with the web.
So what kind of privacy then do you really have?
You have – so that's a big issue with all of the social media is the concern for privacy and how people want to protect and guard their privacy. What I encourage is for people to take an active role in thinking about how they're setting up their privacy. On the other hand, I also recognize that we don't have the same kind of privacy that we had 15 years ago. And I don't have a throw up my hands, well, shucks, no privacy anymore kind of reaction to that. Instead, I recognize our sort of the nature of privacy is changing. People should take an active role in thinking about that. So when a terms of service comes up, actually read the terms of service. I mean, we have this, like, we see so many of them.
It's more than 140 characters.
Yeah, it definitely is. Maybe they should change it so that it is exactly 140 characters. But we've got this sort of culture where it's accept, accept, accept.
Yes,
all of these
right.
windows
that's
pop
right.
up and we just accept everything. There's a way in which we don't have probably time to read every single one of these terms of services. But when you're creating a profile, I mean, when you're essentially occupying a space, it's like coming into the world in a way.
Yeah.
You should be wearing clothes when you do. You should be wearing clothes that you picked out carefully, not just, stumbling out in your pajamas into, what is a really public space.
So those terms of service are in effect notifying you that by subscribing to Twitter or any number of other social media, you are forfeiting a degree of privacy when you – not just when you use those media but also from then on, really.
Well, and the other thing is that the terms of service change really frequently and the privacy settings change very frequently.
Right.
I actually have had much more of a issue with this with Facebook than I have with Twitter. Facebook is a really shifting target. Every time I go onto Facebook, I feel like I'm in a different universe because it's changing so rapidly. It's one of the reasons why I have never liked Facebook as much as I've liked Twitter. Twitter still looks a lot like it did when I first encountered it.
No
They've
pictures.
Added functionality. There are pictures,
are
but
there?
They're not the center of the Twitter universe, which is interesting because it has remained a textual medium in the midst of a web that is become a very pictorial medium. If you look on Twitter or Facebook or Tumblr, what you see are pictures.
Oh, yes. Yes, whether you want to or not.
You launched an experiment called Twitters versus Zombies, and we're going to talk about that when we continue in a moment on University of the Air. The current explosion of digital technology not only is changing the way we live and communicate, but is rapidly and profoundly altering our brains. Because of the current technological revolution, our brains are evolving right now at a speed like never before. So said Gary Small in iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Jesse Stommel, and we are talking about Twitter, among other things. Tell us about this experiment you launched in 2012, Twitter versus Zombies.
So the experiment from 2012 was part of a larger event that I was doing called Digital Writing Month, which was a variation on National Novel Writing Month, which people may have heard of. Essentially, people all over the country writing a novel in the month of November collectively. So we were doing an experiment that was really thinking about how does our writing live in digital spaces? How is email different from writing that we might have done on paper? How is email different from a handwritten correspondence? And thinking about what kind of writing do we do in spaces like Twitter and on our blogs and whatnot. It was an event created by myself and Sean Michael Morris, and Twitter versus Zombies was an experiment within that month. And it was a three-day event, and Twitter versus Zombies was created by myself and a colleague, Pete Roraba. And essentially, what Twitter versus Zombies was a chance to play inside of the space of Twitter. And we didn't actually know what this game was or what it would become when we launched the game. We had a very loose set of objectives. We essentially wanted to create a game within Twitter that focused on Twitter literacies. So essentially the outcome was Twitter literacies. When we started the game, we weren't more specific about the outcomes than that because we really wanted the game to be emergent and we wanted the rules to sort of form during the game itself. So we had three very simple rules and launched the game, promoted it 3 days before the game started, launched it, and sort of watched things go wild and then kind of created the game throughout the 3 days.
What were the rules?
The rules were essentially that you could – it was based on the game Humans versus Zombies, which is a campus game that people play. They may play it at UW-Madison, essentially where, you know, you have a big mass group of people being humans and being zombies and essentially trying to mimic the zombie apocalypse.
Uh-huh.
So the rules were simple. You could bite. And you could bite, and you could dodge,
uh-huh.
and you could swipe. And swipe was to protect a friend. So zombies could bite, and to bite, you had to construct a tweet with the hashtag bite in it at some point.
Right.
And you had to bite a particular person. And then in order to save yourself from that, you could either dodge or you could swipe. You could have a friend swipe the zombie out of the way. And there were different rules about how the tweets were constructed. And then as the game evolved, new hashtags, essentially every about 8 hours, we added rules to the game. And we crowdsourced those rules so that we were in dialogue with the players to determine what the next rule update would contain. And we added different actions. You could create a safe zone. You could have a weapon. And in order to have a weapon, you had to take a picture of a weapon of opportunity. So I might take a picture of my cell phone and then say, I beat to death the zombie with my cell phone, hashtag weapon. And so essentially, what we got were some players who had never used Twitter before being forced in the moment to learn how to do some of these relatively complex Twitter behaviors. They had to figure out what a hashtag was.
Right.
They had to figure out what an at symbol was. They had to figure out how to post a picture. They had to figure out – so like literally your – tweeting to save your life.
And the way you got these new people was to tap into the popularity of zombies or, you know, let's say that somebody had never used Twitter before, what would draw them into the game?
Well, we tapped into the existing audience for the Digital Writing Month. And we also just tapped into our various different networks is what drew people into the game. We also announced the game at an academic conference. And so the academics at that conference not only participated, but some of them also invited their students to participate. And what happened is what became of the game, there's now been three iterations of it. By the second iteration, it was actually groups of students that were running the game. So we kind of backed away from being the moderators. And the second time, it was actually groups of students who were constructing the game space. Essentially, the rules live on a website and inside of Google Docs. And then we were still involved and still playing, but
and
it had kind of gone on without us.
And let's say that you were talking to somebody who felt they paid taxes in the state of Wisconsin for a state university, and here's this professor who is, you know, having a zombie Twitter thing and having students that are doing that as an activity. How would you justify it pedagogically? What is it that a student would gain doing this that they wouldn't if they were cracking the books?
So I think that they would – well, hopefully they would also be cracking the books and thinking and, you know, reading material that was directly relevant to the work that we were doing, as well as thinking about and discussing it in class. But what they would get from it, they would get skills in collaboration. They would get skills in how to communicate on the web. Also, I think that Twitter itself is a really wonderful way to teach concision in writing. So the thing is, in my brain, I always have these sort of reasons why I teach the way that I do and reasons, you know, essentially things that I want to – goals of my class. And I don't necessarily always just lay them right on the table for students. Instead, there's a way in which can I construct an experiment that gets at some of those outcomes in an indirect way. So there's a way in which students don't even realize they're learning exactly the same things that they might learn in a traditional writing class, but learning them from a different angle and an angle that excites them.
How could it help their writing? Give me an example where a student would come up with better writing at the end of this experiment.
Well, I think, for example, the Twitter essay, which you mentioned at the beginning, is something that I've taught. That's actually what first started me using Twitter, was I used it in order to teach the Twitter essay, because I wanted students thinking about disrupting the notion of what a thesis statement is, and so talking about how theses work, mm-hmm. and why we use them, and Twitter became a space where I could literally have them thinking about a sentence and thinking about this sort of argument they were making at a granular level. So I actually had them pull out graph paper and I had them box off 140 squares on the graph paper and literally write every character of their thesis statement into the little boxes of their 140 characters, and then they had to tweet their thesis statement. And so what they learn is they learn that every single character has impact. And this is really true of – it's a really great way to teach punctuation marks, because what you recognize really quickly is that not all characters are have an equal amount of rhetorical content. So you can have a semicolon, and it can actually do – in some cases do the work of 10 characters. And so finding really clever ways and really thoughtful ways to use punctuation is one of the outcomes of doing that activity.
Emoticons?
Emoticons. You know, actually, people are really worried that emoticons are going to show up in student writing. And I don't – I actually think that that's been debunked, that emoticons haven't in mass shown up in student writing.
You're talking about little smiley faces, little emotional faces.
Which you can sometimes build with punctuation, but now they're actually part of the symbol chart in some word programs.
Yeah, indeed. And truth is that I don't think that emoticons are running rampant in student writing. On the other hand, to be honest, I wouldn't mind if they did. I think that they're – what they do is they have a sort of personality, and I want the flair, the sort of voice of a student writing to come through. And there are certain cases where an emoticon is the best way to create that kind of personality. Now, are we going to start having emoticons in our professional writing and our professional publications?
Well, I sort of hope so. I could use a little fluffing up.
Sad face.
But I can see where to convey a certain tone. It's fascinating to compare – language, written language, with music and music notation. In music notation, you have all these clues as to the dynamics of the music. I mean, sometimes almost to a fault, where there's no room for interpretation. But in language, you don't really have, for example, if you want to convey sarcasm or if you want to convey something that's wry. Sometimes the most succinct way to do it, it was with that little semicolon wink.
Yeah, I know the winky. I call him the winky man, and he is my favorite. Like, he's my favorite emoticon because it really achieves something that's important for me. Because I tend to be a bit ironic, and I tend to be a bit satirical in some of my tweets. And if you toss a little winky man at the end of them, it essentially lets people know that there's a glimmer in your eye.
And what was the upshot then of the Twitter versus zombies experiment? What was the outcome? What
you know, more than Twitter literacies, I think that the outcome for me was community building. And that's when it comes to – and this goes back to your question about why tax dollars should be spent on this. I think learning happens in community. And I think that we have to do things in our classrooms, whether they're virtual, face-to-face, to build community. Because that's when – that's when the fires go off in our students. And that's when the fires go off for me. And when the fires are going off for me – and the students, and we have this really rich relationship and this rich dialogue, that's when the most learning happens. And so I guess the biggest outcome was 3 days, a few hundred people, really rich relationships formed.
Archive? Are all the tweets in some kind of digital archive preserved for posterity, or are they part of that, what did you call it, crap stuff?
Crap detection.
Yes. I mean, how much of it is just really not meant to last? It's just something that happens in the moment, but then there's no point in going back because it's not crafted with the same kind of care that a literary masterpiece would be.
I'm a fan of curation, and I'm a fan of – we have an experience in digital space, and I'm a fan of self-reflection and curating our own experience. Essentially, it's a way of collecting our memories the same way we would collect our memories in a scrapbook. And so – when I have experiences or when I have students doing things on the web, I often have as one of the activities for them to curate their experience. So to collect the tweets that were really meaningful, the conversations, the engagements that really meant something, collect them into an archive, a very carefully selected archive. I have a line that I've used before where I say that a landfill is not an archive. And by that, I mean that just a pile of stuff means nothing. unless we've carefully organized it and collected in a specific way that when we come back upon it 10 years later, it actually means something to us. And so for the Twitter versus zombies, there's way too many tweets to say that all of the tweets. There was something like 6,000 to 10,000 tweets over those 3 days. To say that all of those are important is, you know, okay, if they are, what are we ever going to do with 10,000 tweets? No one's going to read 10,000 tweets. And so not only were game players collecting, it actually became one of the hashtags during the game. If you storified and storify is a platform that archives tweets. If you storified your experience of the game, you would then have another action you could do at that point in the game. And so what you can find now is you can find my archive of the various storifies that were created in the game.
So getting back to this mention at the beginning of this part of the conversation that our brains are evolving even as we speak because of Twitter. That seemed to be the implication there. Do you have a sense that that we're really becoming, because of Twitter, super short-form thinkers and communicators?
I don't think so. I mean, my gut says that there were people's brains that already worked that way and that Twitter has become the ideal space for them to inhabit, and it becomes a medium that they can really thrive within. So I don't necessarily think that Twitter is changing our brains. I think that everything that we encounter, all the digital stuff, the collective weight of our culture changing is transforming our brains in certain ways. But I wouldn't necessarily say that Twitter by itself has that kind of impact.
What about transforming our behavior? Because it seems to me that it promotes a kind of lack of patience in a way, that, or lack of sustained attention, that there is this feeling of instant response and little bits and fragments that would make doing something alone, like reading War and Peace with no response, nobody to share it with, just the way sometimes it seems as if children's toys that are all now computer animated and talk back make it so that a just simple wooden truck looks like not enough. Do you feel that there is possibly a downside to the excessive use of things like Twitter in terms of people's attention span?
Absolutely. And I'll say that, I'll speak from my perspective. What I've noticed is that being isolated, being alone for long periods, I experience that differently. I experience it with more anxiety than I would have prior to these social media, because there's a way in which with social media and with a cell phone in my pocket, I always have people right at my fingertips. I don't necessarily know that's a bad thing. To me, it creates this sense of constant community, that I always have a community right in my pocket with me. And I think there's a lot of ways that that's a good thing. But on the other hand, when I'm tweeting on the treadmill, which I do, I there's a certain part of me that says, should I be tweeting on the treadmill? But I don't necessarily know that I shouldn't. Sure, I should take some moments for solitary reflection, but I don't necessarily think that that solitary reflection is it by its nature being lost with something like Twitter.
It does make you wonder a little bit, though, if tweeting constantly doesn't somehow dilute the experience of the moment at hand. It's kind of like, photographers who they'll go on a vacation and everything they see is through a frame on the camera, because they're so wired into taking pictures of it.
Yeah, indeed. And I don't take travel photography for that reason. I'm actually a photographer, but I don't – when I'm traveling, I don't take photographs because I want to be looking at what I'm seeing. And also, this goes back to the Howard Rheingold book, that it's not necessarily the medium but how you use it. And this is true about any medium.
Right.
So the thing is, there's no affordances of the Twitter medium that are necessarily going to do damage to us.
That's
but like any
it.
Medium – if you, I mean, even Emerson wrote, books are the best of things, well used, among the worst when abused. I butchered that quote a little bit. But the gist is that we said the same things about the novel, and we said the same things about books, and we said the same things about email. And we're having those same conversations about Twitter as though it's somehow a different conversation than the conversation that Emerson was having.
That's true. I mean, any medium, if you want to like start with a printing press, for example, it has its uses and its abuses from the get-go.
Exactly.
Let's listen to some tweets from our guest when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Jesse Stommel, who is filling us in on the phenomenon known as Twitter. That means tweets and hashtags and a variety of very compact language and building networks and communities and all of that kind of thing. So give us some examples of some successful hashtags and tweets, and don't forget the at sign too. It's a little tricky to do for audio, but I think we get the idea.
I predict at Kathy N. Davidson's course will sound the death knell for MOOC hype. And then a link. She has built the Ouroboros of MOOCs. A couple more. The position of deciding what you want to be when you grow up is a privileged one. To improve test scores, our best strategy is to teach students how to take risks. Pedagogical experimentation means risking failure. Teachers and administrators should engage students in conversation about those failures.
The last two or three of those sounded quite traditional in their use of language, but there, in the first one there was lingo that was beyond me.
Then the MOOC? Is that the massive
open
online
course?
Okay.
Yeah. So these were examples from my own tweets and tweets that have generated a good amount of conversation. Interestingly, my most successful tweet of the last, and by success, I'm not sure exactly what I mean. By success, in this case, it got retweeted a lot, which means it got sort of proliferated across other people's feeds. My most successful one I didn't read was actually a quote, wasn't even written by me. Peter Elbow writes, "When students struggle for excellence only for the sake of a grade, what we see is not motivation, but atrophy of motivation." What's interesting to me is that I've actually found that some of the most successful tweets, and by success, I mean they got retweeted, but even more importantly, that they generated discussion and conversation, because that's what I'm after. That's why I'm on Twitter. I'm not on it to proliferate my ideas or my thinking. I'm on it to generate discussion. The most successful tweets for me have been ones that didn't use a lot of lingo and that were really accessible to people new to the Twitter platform. I find that the more at symbols I throw and the more hashtags I throw, sure, it can help convey to an insular Twitter audience. But I find that just some of the most simple, a quote from something that was written in a book ends up being successful because it's accessible to anyone, even the folks that just have wandered upon Twitter.
Some of the ones you read reminded me of fortune cookies. We all like to open that fortune cookie and then you read a little aphorism sometime and then you try to apply it to yourself and see if you can make it fit. The first one sounded like almost like a personal attack on another teacher.
Actually, it wasn't an attack at all. It was a huge compliment. I was trying to pay her a huge compliment.
Okay, then I needed that winking face.
And she recognized it as a compliment and then retweeted and shared it.
Okay, so the part about the death knell.
Of MOOCs.
Yeah, I mean, essentially I was arguing that she is going to create the MOOC to end all MOOCs. Essentially by the MOOC to end all MOOCs, like the best, the sort of MOOC that reimagines the form of the MOOC.
What about the problem of anonymity on Twitter? One of the things that drives me nuts about, let's say, comments on a newspaper article is that people can post something, often very, very nasty, and then hide behind an anonymous identifier where you don't even know who it is that has put some nasty thing. What about on Twitter? How nasty does it get?
Well, I find that the comment culture in some of our big online publications is the worst, one of the worst cultures that exists, sheerly because of that anonymity factor, where you'll have an article and then you'll have these fights happening in the comments of the article that end up having nothing to do with the mm-hmm. article itself,
right.
just
right.
general nastiness, and also people correcting each other's punctuation. There's a place for editing, but it's not in the comments space on a, on an article, online article. I find that Twitter is one of the more hospitable, actually, of the various digital cultures that I've been a part of. It doesn't mean it's without fault. There are certain aspects of Twitter and a kind of cyberbullying that happens on Twitter that is just as pernicious as what can happen anywhere. What can happen in a comment space on an online publication? What can happen on a playground? So again, it gets back to this idea that it's how you use the medium. And, so there are various different strategies for using Twitter that end up essentially the affordance of the medium, the sort of 140-character limit, requires that we take a little care with how we interact with people and that we put the wink face in when we mean something to be satire or when we mean something to be a pleasant, happy jab at someone.
I suppose, unlike Facebook, for example, or an email or other forms of e-communication, that 140-character limit for Twitter requires a level of thoughtfulness that might rule out the kind of the snap response to something that would tend toward the less kind.
I think so. That's how it works for me, and that's how I encourage my students and how I encourage my colleagues to use it. It isn't necessarily how everyone uses it. I mean, essentially, the 140-character limit, oftentimes you start typing a tweet and you realize you're 30 characters over the limit.
That's
and
right.
You have to really carefully hone your tweet in order to get it under the limit. And so that means you are using – you tend to be using a little more care. But you can – just like any other space, you can throw off three words and just totally decimate someone's entire identity and existence. And, that's just not nice. That's not the Twitter medium. That's just an unkind person.
Presumably one of the things you like about it is its democratic nature. And that certainly played a role abroad sometimes in areas where there was a lot of restriction. Social media, Facebook and Twitter could kind of get the word out and get things spread in areas that we don't think of as having democracy.
Yeah, actually something that I'm thinking about a lot lately and something that I'm developing a course about is digital activism, thinking about how we use these spaces to organize. And particularly I've been thinking a lot lately about adjunct professors and thinking about ways for adjunct professors to organize across the country using mediums like Twitter and using social media.
So, Twitter is free. It's very quick and easy to sign up to do tweets. Is it something that's traceable, though? I mean, in these situations, I'm thinking about, again, something like the Arab Spring where somebody is at the scene of a situation and they tweet it and it gets retweeted around the world. Is that person somebody who could be found by people who disapprove of that tweet?
Well, one thing is there is geotagging in tweets, and you can turn off geotagging so that your location isn't tweeted. I currently have it turned on, so someone can literally track my movement across the country via my tweets because they're all geotagged.
And you like being geotagged. Why?
I like being geotagged because I have a sort of interest in transparency and an interest in sort of being vulnerable in spaces. And I think that the issue with vulnerability is that vulnerability is possible from a position of privilege. So there's a certain privilege I have that allows me to choose to let myself be vulnerable in a space like this. I don't think that that's true for everyone. Not everyone has the privilege to make the choice to be vulnerable. They just are
right.
in a vulnerable position
mm-hmm.
because someone else has put them in that position. And so I think Twitter can, again, like anything, Twitter could be used as a weapon against that person.
How does it work with multiple languages and translations and so on? Like when you do a sort of online mass kind of in effect a crowd project, how do the different languages come in?
One thing that I like about Twitter is that the languages sort of coexist alongside of each other, And some of the folks that I follow are bilingual or multilingual and use multiple languages sometimes within a single tweet. And I find that lovely. And the thing is, you can curate your feed in different ways so that essentially you create that multilingual feed. I don't necessarily think that's happening rampantly. I think people, you know, tend to follow people speaking in their own language.
What do you mean when you said you can curate your thing to – I don't know what that meant.
Essentially, it means that you can follow – you can be very careful in who you choose to follow. And so you can choose to follow people who are speaking multilingually or people who are speaking in a language that's not your mm-hmm. own. And I sort of make it part of my ethic when I'm choosing who to follow that I make sure to not choose people who look just like me, who not choose people who think just like me, to make sure that my feed is not an echo chamber. It's a criticism often of social media that you just collect a bunch of people who agree with you and then you end up with this echo chamber. Uh-huh. I think that all it takes in order to create an environment that isn't an echo chamber is the decision not to do it. I mean, it's easy to build an echo chamber if that's what you want. If you don't want an echo chamber, you carefully look for people you respect but disagree with
A little analogous to a newspaper. I mean, I think that we tend to read the columnists we agree with and skip over the ones that have, you know, the titles that we don't like. But in this case, you can assure or make sure that you're going to get some of those opposing opinions.
Yeah, and sometimes I share things that I don't agree with. I share articles that I've found. For me, what the bulk of Twitter is for me is having a conversation about my work and my work being just education really broadly writ. Having a conversation about my work and also sharing stuff that I find. And I use it as my morning paper. So when I get up in the morning, I don't read the morning paper. I don't go to USA Today. I don't go to the New York Times. I go to Twitter, and that's how I find the stories I'm going to read that day. And it's a real sort of jamboree of stuff that I come across like a newspaper.
There's an interesting analysis of Twitter done not too long ago that shows that it's something like 37% conversation and 40% just kind of aimless babble, maybe 5% self-promotion, of 3 or 4% spam. Mm-hmm. Not too bad considering that it's such an open medium.
Mm-hmm. I don't find my feed doesn't feel really spammy. And again, you know, I just watch really carefully. If I see spammy stuff happening in my feed, I unfollow the person. And over time, I develop a really well – I don't at one moment spend 16 hours working on my list of the people that I follow. Instead, just over time, it becomes something that I've honed. I've honed a really – a feed that means something to me, that's filled with people I like, filled with my friends, also filled with people that I disagree with, people that I respect, people that share – articles that I'm interested in. A few I keep a few celebrities in there just to kind of – they're for like color.
You seem to talk about Twitter poetry some in your articles. Mm-hmm. Emily Dickinson on Twitter?
I think Emily Dickinson would love Twitter. I think that Emily Dickinson has a sort of sense for that power of every single character. Thinking
well,
about
epigrammatic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. And thinking about what every character does and really thinking about language as power. And I don't necessarily mean political power. I mean political power as one potential power, but also emotional power as a way of conveying things that can't be conveyed. I mean, there's a way in which an Emily Dickinson poem conveys something that you couldn't actually convey in a 2,000-word essay. She is able to capture something with few words that we probably couldn't throw a whole novel at in order to capture. And so there's a way in which Twitter, for me, allows me to express things that I might not be able to express in any other medium. Partly for me, it's the constraint. Partly for me, it's the sort of forcing me to really carefully craft every character.
Based on how Twitter has evolved in these past several years since its inception, where do you see it going?
You know, year over year, it almost doubles the number of tweets that are being done. On the other hand, I think that part of me, like a nagging part of my gut, says it'll go away. It'll go
really?
Away because something else will replace it, because mm-hmm. we'll move, it'll iterate. And it isn't that Twitter itself will go away. It's that we sort of migrate in and out of different parts of digital culture.
Yes.
There's no part of digital culture that looks anything like what I remember from 15 years ago. So to imagine that digital culture 15 years from now will look anything like it looks today is I can't fathom that.
I'm waiting for the multimedia 3D Twitter to come in.
Yeah, the truth is that I hope Twitter sticks around, and the reason why I hope it sticks around is because I like its incessant textuality. I love images, and I actually love platforms that are showing me lots of images. But I also love that we have this immensely popular social media that is so stripped down and simple and almost mm-hmm. elegant and isn't cluttered. And so I hope it sticks around, or something like it sticks around, for that reason. To me, it's sort of relaxing. It's meditative. Meditative.
Again, it's how you use it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Our guest has been Jesse Stommel. Jesse, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.